Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the diversion of Ryanair Flight 4978. With me to discuss Belarus's move to force a commercial airliner to land in Minsk in order to arrest a dissident is Steven Sestanovich. Steve is a George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at CFR and the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of International Diplomacy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. From 1997 to 2001, he was U.S. Ambassador at Large for the former Soviet states. He is the author of Maximalist, America in the World, From Truman to Obama. Steve, thanks for being here.
A pleasure, Jim.
Now, Steve, last Sunday, Belarusian officials dispatched a fighter jet to force a commercial Ryanair jet flying over Belarus en route from Greece to Lithuania to change course and land instead in Minsk. The justification given for diverting the flight was that Belarus had been informed that the Palestinian group Hamas had placed a bomb aboard the plane. I should note at the time that the plane was closer to its intended destination, Vilnius, than to Minsk. So let me begin with a basic question, Steve. Any chance that that bomb threat was real?
Well, it's very implausible because, first of all, they didn't find the bomb when they brought the plane down. It now turns out that the email that the Belarusian authorities are claiming they received from Hamas was actually sent after the notification to the plane. And it doesn't seem as though it was from Hamas at all. Hamas has denied it. So it would be pretty hard to make this case in court.
Okay, so let's get to the real motives operating here. Why do you think Belarus committed what has been widely called a state-sponsored plane hijacking?
Well, for pretty obvious reasons. The guy they were after, Roman Protasevich, is the, in their mind, the evil genius behind a very successful Telegram channel, which has gained a great audience in Belarus, has been instrumental in organizing demonstrations against the regime. And, you know, authoritarian leaders want to take out their opponents wherever they can, even if they're outside their territory. So this seemed like an opportunity to get him, because clearly the Belarusian KGB had been following him, saw that he was on the plane. It seems likely that there were KGB people on the plane.
News reports suggest that 126 passengers were on board. Mr. Protasevich and his girlfriend did not board the flight that went from Minsk to Vilnius, and three other unidentified individuals also stayed behind in Minsk, leading to the speculation that they worked for the Belarusians. So can you tell us a little bit more about Mr. Protasevich? What I know is that he's the co-founder of the Telegram messenger app Next to Channel, which I see has something on the order of 2+ million subscribers.
He is one of the brains behind the opposition effort that has, since last summer's controversial elections, gained a tremendous public following inside Belarus and outside probably as well. And in that respect, poses an increased threat to the Lukashenko regime. Recently, the opposition has announced, which the opposition, by the way, based in Lithuania, mostly it's the opposition in exile, has announced plans for new demonstrations in the course of the summer. And so this kind of upped the ante from the Lukashenko regime's point of view as a reason to try to take out some of these people. But there has also been more activity of other kinds to try to generate a kind of crisis atmosphere. In the last month, the Russian FSB and the Belarusian KGB, their sister organization, announced that they'd caught some Belarusian oppositionists in Moscow who were planning a coup to assassinate President Lukashenko. And this has created a lot of kind of hysterical rhetoric at high levels in both Russia and Belarus.
Is there any sense that that was actually taking place, planning for a coup? Or is this just a sort of rhetoric you would expect from an authoritarian regime trying to hang on and trying to demonize its opponents?
We don't know very much about it, Jim. These don't seem to be very prominent figures. Some of them are, one is said to have been a Polish national, another maybe a Canadian national. The point of it really, I think, is not to actually forestall an imminent coup, but to create an atmosphere of crisis, and in particular, to make the point that Western governments are colluding to bring down Lukashenko in pursuit of a policy of regime change. And this is not just, you know, an hysterical Lukashenko claim. Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia restated it just this week in an interview, saying that Western intelligence services had to be part of this operation. It was a prominent theme, not very much reported in the Western media, I should say, in Putin's State of the Union speech to Parliament last month. So the Russians have definitely participated in trying to create this atmosphere of pitting Russia and Belarus against its Western enemies.
I want to get to the Russians in a moment, Steve, but I want to just ask one more question about Lukashenko and his hold on power. I will note that state-sponsored hijackings of commercial airliners is pretty rare. I only know of two instances. One was way back in 1956 when France forced a plane containing an Algerian independence leader to land. Another, more recently, was in 2010 when Iran forced a flight from Dubai to Kyrgyzstan to land in Tehran so it could arrest the leader of a Sunni militant opposition group. So as I look at this step that Lukashenko has taken, is this a sign of desperation on his part?
Well, you know, actions of this sort often reflect both anxiety and confidence. He obviously feels that these people are closing in on him in the sense that he's not been able, even through rather significant repression of demonstrations inside Belarus, to completely break this opposition spirit. He has been given some support from the Russians, as this sort of phony coup case indicates, some reassurance that if he undertakes actions of this kind, they'll stand behind him. So he's anxious about his opposition, confident about Russian support.
Now, for a number of years, Lukashenko had sought to distance himself from Russia and Putin. But ever since last summer, when Belarusians took to the streets to protest his theft of the presidential election, Minsk has become something of a vassal to Moscow. What are the odds that Lukashenko would launch an operation like this without a green light from the Kremlin and from Vladimir Putin himself?
This is an issue that really rankles Russians. The automatic suggestion, or the leapt to conclusion of Westerners, that the Russians had to be behind it. It rankles the Belarusians a little bit too, of course, because it suggests that, well, they're really not up to an operation of this kind. Their intelligence operation is not good enough. But the Russians are annoyed because they regard this as an example of Lukashenko going a little haywire on his own, ready to take risks, as some Russian commentators have said, at a time when Putin and Biden have scheduled their summit a couple of weeks from now. So, you know, the Russian suggestion is, why would we have done this? It doesn't do us any good. We have our more refined and delicate polite society ways of dealing internationally, even with our foes. The problem is they haven't been willing to actually criticize this. Foreign Minister Lavrov said the operation was completely reasonable. And plenty of Russian commentators, the head of Russian television, for example, have said the same thing, said Lukashenko handled it beautifully. So they can't resist the satisfaction of endorsing something that seems to rankle the West, but they also feel they've got to stand behind their guy. Jim, your point about Lukashenko being a vassal does need some fleshing out, because he has become economically more dependent on Putin. He has developed greater cooperation on both the military and intelligence fronts. There now is an agreement that they'll set up joint training centers in both countries. They're going to have military exercises this summer. So the military security establishments of both sides are cooperating closely. But Lukashenko himself is kind of constrained in pushing this too far. When just minutes before he was leaving for his meeting with Putin in Sochi, he rejected the idea that they would be advancing the merger of the two states under this 25-year-old agreement to have a binational state. He said, this is absolutely impossible. And he used rather lurid language. He said, we can't have a colonial takeover, an enslavement. He referred to it as, said there would be a terrible rebuff in this country for anything of that sort. One thing that has happened in the past couple of years has been a kind of nascent Belarusian nationalism. And the idea that they would be absorbed by Russia is genuinely unpopular there. And Lukashenko has to respect that, because the only way he can hold off Putin's pressures is by saying this will create havoc within the country.
Now, Steve, we're recording this before the Memorial Day weekend, but I believe that as we speak, or shortly after we speak, President Lukashenko is supposed to meet with President Putin at Sochi, as you mentioned. I don't know if we're going to get a readout between the leaders of those two countries, or to what extent we could put any stock in what that readout might be. But how do you imagine that conversation is going?
You know, Putin may well be a little unhappy with this dust up. He doesn't like having sanctions talk revived in the West. Sanctions talk that focuses on Belarus, but that does involve a lot of accusations against Russia. At the same time, Putin has a long game of building influence in, you could say, control over Belarus and ultimately the absorption. And we've seen that increased pressure. I think in a previous conversation on the president's inbox, I described this as a kind of takeover from inside. And Putin wants that to continue. But he has now become aware that Lukashenko is going to fight it and deny Putin the satisfaction of a Crimea-like absorption of a large part of old Soviet territory. So I would guess that the conversation will be one in which Putin says, Mr. President, I'm with you. Those outrageous Western democracy promoting scum are our common enemies. And where you need it, we've got your back. If it costs something because of economic sanctions, we're here for you. But I think we need to understand that together we can only succeed against the West unless we continue to develop our institutional cooperation, meaning I'd really like to have my guys, you know, in a better position to know about what's going on so there are no surprises. And this sort of surprise, Mr. President, has not been 100% a success from my point of view. Sure, you got a little 26-year-old hothead blogging genius, but really, we'll take care of problems like that. We'll keep you in power and you don't have to do silly things of that sort. Now, that's an extended riff on Putin talking to Lukashenko. And Lukashenko, I think, is going to say back to him, you know, I'm really appreciative of your support. I have to tell you, I understand the people of Belarus better than you. And you've got to have some confidence in me that when I need to take out a guy like this Protasevich, it's necessary.
To be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
I should say, Steve, are you referring to the last time you were on the president's inbox? That was our September 8, 2020 show. We discussed the protests that broke out in Belarus in the wake of the presidential election. I want to turn now to the question of the reaction elsewhere to the diversion of the flight, which I think in the West is largely described as a hijacking. There's been widespread condemnation of Belarus's action from European capitals, from the United States. I note that many European countries have moved to ban their national airlines from flying to airports in Belarus, from flying through Belarusian airspace, and they're banning the Belarusian national airline, I didn't know it had one, Belavia, from landing on their territory. There's talk about increasing existing sanctions that have been in place because of the stolen presidential elections. How far should we expect these sanctions to go, and how punitive will they be?
You know, the EU acts very deliberately and slowly, but they have made clear that this is a process and that the last shoe has not dropped. One thing Putin and Lukashenko surely talked about at Sochi is how much further this could go. I suspect that one of them said to the other, you know, the German foreign minister, Heiko Maas, commented after the last meeting that they had, the foreign foreign ministers on Thursday, the 27th, he said, unless there are Belarusian concessions, we are looking ahead to a long spiral of sanctions. Meaning his read of the meeting, and he's probably the most influential of the foreign ministers there, his read of the meeting is there's a kind of commitment to keep tightening the pressure. The Americans are, of course, going to be asked to do the same thing, although there's much less trade between Belarus and the United States than there is with the EU.
What do you make, Steve, of Lukashenko's threat that he's going to allow migrants and drugs to pour into Europe if sanctions are imposed on his regime?
It's a reflection of his weak position. That's the only good threat that he's got. It may be that Lukashenko will, in fact, try to make trouble of various kinds, allowing illegal immigrants to pass through, allowing drugs. But he has a problem in sort of the basic threat that he made about opening the borders. Because one of the things he's got to worry about is that you're going to have a flood of migration out of Belarus. You create an atmosphere of crisis. You have the prospect of economic decline, even worse than it's been. And suddenly a lot of people are going to say, well, maybe I want to get out of here. We don't know what kind of receptivity there's going to be on the part of Belarus's other neighbors, the Poles, the Latvians, the Lithuanians, the Ukrainians. You know, are all places where Belarusians could think of migrating, and even Russia. There's been a large migration from Belarus to Russia over the past 20 years because Russia has been a more prosperous place. For Lukashenko, opening the borders is a kind of two-edged sword, and he'll have to be pretty careful with that one.
Let's talk about the U.S. response. You mentioned, Steve, that the United States doesn't have much in the way of trade with Belarus. So any sanctions the United States imposes are probably going to fall in the symbolic category. But President Biden has made a considerable deal about how he views the world as a contest now between democracies and authoritarians. And he wants democracies to win and authoritarians to lose. So that creates an incentive to try to find a way to punish Lukashenko and his regime. On the other hand, next month, Joe Biden is going to be sitting down with Vladimir Putin in Geneva for their first one-on-one. And how do you square that circle?
Well, you've focused on sort of ideology and geopolitics there, but let me start in a slightly different place, which I think is still where a lot of governments are focused. And that is another Biden theme, that is the rules-based international order. You know, we've all suddenly become experts on international civil aviation. You know, suddenly I know, and you know, that there was a global agreement in 1970, the Montreal Convention on Civil Aviation, about protecting airliners against false threats that would endanger people. Belarus, by the way, ratified it. There's the further Chicago Convention that established the International Civil Aviation Organization and regime, global regime. And I think a lot of the anxiety about what happened in Belarus starts with this element of fear, the idea that, and this gets to the next question you raise, which is, can we actually allow authoritarian leaders to, you know, shake up the rules in this way that actually creates not just political advantages for them, but endangers the way the whole global order seems to work. So I think you've got an escalating sense of danger here that actually stiffens the spines of the US and European policymakers. And you add to that the geopolitics of it. People have suggested that Biden will not want to make too much of a deal out of this because he's looking for a good meeting with Putin. But Biden is somebody who's taken Putin's measure, is very conscious of the importance of not being misread in an early encounter, and wants to convey to Putin that this is really the kind of international piracy that we can't abide and that you're going to have to take a stand against. I'd add one other part to this that is important for Europeans as well as the United States, and that's geography. You know, Belarus is actually a bigger, more strategically located part of Central Europe than people sometimes imagine. You know, I was interviewed on Russian television yesterday, and they said to me, do Americans really even know where Belarus is on the map? Well, actually, most of us don't. But the truth is, it's got NATO members on its its border. It's got a long border with Ukraine and a set of unfolding crises that led to the Russians making a full takeover of Belarus would shake up the security situation in Europe. So I think there are these three elements of the problem are very much on the minds of policymakers. This sort of the underlying question of the rules, the ideological confrontation with authoritarians, and the geopolitical power balance. And that is all to say there's a lot riding on what happens to this 26-year-old blogger. You know, he's become a key element in a contest that goes way beyond him, I think, in the minds of European and American policymakers.
I will note that the 26-year-old blogger was on Belarusian TV on Monday saying that he had been reasonably treated, though by some accounts he looked to have been bruised in a way he wasn't when he was on the plane.
Lukashenko's police, his intelligence services are not famed for gentle treatment of their political opponents. And I'd be very surprised if he wasn't roughed up a little bit.
Steve, I want to go back to where you began your answer to my last question about the rules-based order and about maintaining these rules. And I will note that, you know, we've been talking about this issue in the context of a particular plane being diverted, but you could also view it as just another in a string of examples recently about what might be called transnational repression or authoritarian governments sort of reaching out beyond their borders to be able to crush opposition, to pursue opponents. I mean, maybe the greatest case of that in recent years was the 2018 killing of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. But you also have Rwandan President Paul Kagame giving interviews in which he's bragged about an operation his government carried out to abduct an exiled dissident. There are other examples like this. How do you, as a Western government devoted to a rules-based order, combat that? And I ask the question, particularly since there will be a lot of what we call whataboutism, foreign capital saying the United States over the years has engaged in renditions, kidnappings of people it is designated as terrorists.
Yeah, the whataboutism is definitely an important element of this, not least because people like Putin have convinced themselves that this is really just the way the world operates and that there isn't, for all of their moral preening, any difference between Western governments and his own treatment of his opponents. But I think that it's a conviction on the part of somebody like Putin. And I know this part of the world better than the broader universe that you've mentioned. I think the anxiety that goes along with it has to do with an uncertainty about his own legitimacy and the question of what would happen if he didn't resort to this kind of repression. I mean, the thing about, you know, Western governments is that, yes, there can be an anxiety about releasing prisoners from Guantanamo. But all in all, Western governments feel pretty confident that the stability of the regime is pretty secure against the, you know, opposition that you're describing, that maybe opponents in exile, the prospect of popular uprisings. For Putin and Lukashenko, that's a more immediate wolf at the door kind of anxiety, an anxiety about what will really happen to them if they simply sit by and let their opponents exploit every opportunity of the internet, exploit every opportunity of getting support abroad, whether it's grants or other kinds of financial support. What will happen if they really allow free and fair elections? I mean, I think Lukashenko got a pretty big scare last year. He thought he could actually do okay by just letting his main opponent's wife run against him. And it turned out, actually, popular support was so great for her that he had to just make up the results. Putin, I think, isn't quite there yet. He's got a little more confidence that he can hold off against this kind of opposition. but he's anxious. And just this week, the Russian parliament has passed another round of laws making it impossible for what they call extremists to run for office, meaning extremists are anybody that voices determined enough opposition to the Putinist regime. So on the broader question that you raised, which is what Western governments can do about this, they have a problem because a lot of the source of the difficulty comes from the anxiety that these leaders have about their legitimacy. And they have lots of means at their disposal here and there to bend the rules, to exploit their freedom of action where they can find it in a way that it's hard for Western governments to cope with. You mentioned the case of reaching beyond borders to attack opponents. The best way to deal with that is to try to punish it. When the Russian security services used chemical agents against a former intelligence officer in England, the appropriate response was a lot of sanctions. When Alexei Navalny was almost assassinated through the use of internationally banned chemical agents, again, the response was a kind of outrage. Has it saved Navalny from prison? No. Has it put the Russian regime on the defensive? You bet.
Steve, that seems to me to point to the real delicacy of these strategies, because as you know, regime behavior is driven by insecurity and they're trying to address what they perceive to be threats to their legitimacy. And your response naturally is, as you say, you not only want to, but need to punish this because it is eroding the very norm-based, rule-based order that you have and your predecessors spent decades trying to build. But in doing so, you're actually heightening the insecurity of these regimes, sort of getting this cycle continuing. But the flip side is if you don't challenge them, if you try to hold out a carrot, domestically, that's likely to be pretty unpopular, but it's also not clear that it's going to get you cooperation. They just pocket your concession and continue to behave badly. And I think that's sort of one of the challenges that policymakers, particularly in the United States, but not solely in the United States, have to grapple with.
Yeah, in the case of Belarus, the dilemma is especially stark because the more you put pressure on Lukashenko, the greater the risk that you will increase Putin's control over Belarus. So you may weaken one authoritarian leader and strengthen another who is actually considerably more dangerous and problematic from the standpoint of overall Western interests. This is a problem that, you know, all Western policymakers have faced in the post-Soviet space since the Soviet Union itself collapsed. How to try to shore up leaders of states on the Russian periphery who may not always be the most appetizing characters, but whose success is seen as a valuable part of an American policy to try to keep the Soviet Union from being reassembled and to prevent the outbreak of kind of conflict among all of these states. For 30 years, we've been coping with that problem. I'll mention that the Trump administration answer to this question was to try to reach out to Belarus. Both Secretary Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton visited Minsk, which was a kind of unprecedented level of attention. And it inspired Lukashenko to a certain kind of defiance of the Russians. That policy was undone, though, not by Western mishandling, but by his own insecurity and exactly the way that you've described. There's nothing that John Bolton or Mike Pompeo could say to Lukashenko that would protect him against the prospect of losing an election. And once that happened last summer, all bets were off. Is there any kind of implication in that for how you deal with the two authoritarians right now? You know, I would say one possibility that U.S. and European governments should consider is, you know, a kind of quiet outreach to Lukashenko in which they say, you better understand how severe the level of pressure is going to be. We're not nearly done yet with sanctions. And you know what the result of that is going to be. It's going to be Putin hounding you for greater and greater control. But If you are willing to let Mr. Protasevich out and his girlfriend, no questions asked, the whole thing, we will call off. We will unwind those sanctions. We're not looking to bring you down. You are bringing yourself down. And that is what, in the long term, we think guarantees a democratic future for Belarus. But, you know, your future is going to be a lot worse. Your ability to fend off Putin is going to be a lot less if you continue doing what you've done. You've got to find a way to play the authoritarians against each other.
On that note of policy guidance, we're going to close the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Steve Sestanovich, the George F. Kennan Senior Fellow for Russian and Eurasian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, thank you again for joining me.
A pleasure, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or a guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Marcus Zachariah was our recording engineer. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.